Diakonia is the Greek word that they're called by, and it actually means, it's actually referring to service, because the office of a deacon is an office of service. So that's where we get the word diakonia, and it's that's where it's derived from, is the term service. And the statement in verse 5 about Nicholas, it begins to introduce them here. And it pleased the multitude, obviously, that they were about to elect these individuals or ask for some of the members to put forward these names of these individuals. And the term proselyte here that's used for Nicholas in verse 5, he's described as a proselyte, is from the Greek word proselyton. And it is actually two words in Greek, pros or pros, which is P-R-O-S. It means to or with. And erchomai is one of the past tenses of a word meaning to come or to go. And so actually it means to those that are coming or to the ones coming or the ones being converted is another way to say it. Those coming to the truth or coming to a knowledge of God. So in the New Testament, it means basically a Gentile that is being converted to Judaism as they saw it. And the word was not applied to those non-Jews that were called devout or God-fearers in some cases, suboumenos. Which is a suboumenos ton theon, which is religious people of God, or those who did not submit to circumcision, but participated in the synagogue and in the worship of the synagogue, and observed basic tenets or customs of the Jews. And they observed the Jewish laws, but and their customs as well. So the expression devout proselytes, in Acts 13, verse 43, I think is where it's also referred to, is kind of curious and may emphasize some fully worshiping proselytes. In verse 6, the story continues here about picking out these individuals. These individuals were put before the apostles. The disciples were making the choice, not the congregation, technically. The congregation was saying, these are names, these are individuals that we all respect, and they were being distinctly set apart for a purpose, and at the same time bestowing an extra portion of God's Spirit being put upon them so that they might serve in this capacity. The word here in Greek is epithemi, and it actually means to put, to lay upon, to put upon someone. And then charis is the word for hands. We talk about a care package because a care package is put together by loving hands for someone. And charis is the word for hands. And so they're putting their hands on these individuals to, or putting upon these individuals, God's Spirit to help them assist and to serve, from which we actually get the word hand or hands as well, charis. They are caring for others. They are serving others with the hands. It's spelled K-E-I-R-A-S if you're looking for a spelling of it in English, but E-I in Greek is always pronounced as a long A, so it's charis rather than kairos, I guess is maybe the way we would say it in English, but the A-S on the end is an ending. The root of the word is actually care, K-E-I-R, from which we get, you know, we talk about care packages, things like that, but that's the Greek word for hand, or hands. And it's because those loving hands and caring hands are doing something for someone else or being in service to someone else. In verse 7, it talks about the nation to whom they will be in bondage. I will be judge, said God. And this is kind of a shows just how fast the faith of God is actually beginning to spread among the empire, so to speak, or among Jews in the empire. And it's a marvelous thing to watch God's word carried and begin to quickly work in the minds of human beings. And that's kind of what's happening here. It's a marvelous thing to see God do this, and to see the leadership, having a need, because there are so many people who are beginning to come to God that the apostles, the 11 now elected 12 apostles that are once again 12, there's just not enough of them to go around. There's not enough of them to do all of the things that need to be done. So the church is growing at a rate that is outgrowing its leadership very rapidly. And in a way, we have a similar situation today in the church. We are outgrowing the number of young men we have who can go out on the field and become pastors as well. And we're trying to put as many men as we can into that role as is possible to do so. But it's hard to fill all of those positions that are needed. And so, similar to our situation today, and similar to situations that we had right after the last breakup that we have in the church, you're always needing more leaders the minute those kinds of things happen. Well, it's now happening to the apostles, and they're learning we've got to do something about this. And so that's where we begin to encounter this whole story of the deacons being added. And from time to time, we all have to stand up for our beliefs before those who were previously members of the church, but there were some who refused to abide by the principles of the faith, and in this case, there were probably some here that they lost as well. We lose a few as time goes by, but we need to replace and to replenish the leadership. Sometimes it's just simply due to retirement. Sometimes, in our case today, it's mostly that we have older ministers. They're reaching retirement age, or they're reaching problems of health, various other things that are taking more of our leadership out of leadership roles. So we need to replace them. Verse 8, he goes on and he's talking about these deacons and what they do. Then we give them the covenant of circumcision, and so Abraham begot Isaac and circumcised him in the eighth day, and Isaac begot Jacob, and Jacob begot the 12 patriarchs. It's Peter going on here and talking about this concept of calling, this concept of passing things on generation to generation. And these gentlemen were being put before the apostles for selection, for their blessing, for their ordination, for their God's Spirit being put on them. And then in verse 8, we have men ordained like Stephen in particular. We're going to begin to see his story develop as we look at it. He's performing great wonders and signs among the people. Okay, well, there's something very special about this ordination of Stephen. The original intent of their organization was for them to become physical servants, to help administer tables, to take care of the needs of the elderly and the widows, and those kinds of things, in a physical sense. But what happened was they began to do spiritual, special things, wonders and signs that maybe weren't expected, but that's because the church is growing at a rapid rate, and God knew that they were going to need something more than just, the physical deacons that they were looking for, which maybe should have indicated to the leadership that it was maybe time to begin to ordain elders, too. And they'll begin to figure that out very soon as well. We'll see that in the story, too. Which may be, something that they should have recognized and, in effect, begin to put into a process that they had for that as well. The God was giving a great deal of growth here, And when you have a great deal of growth, you're going to need more leaders as well. And today, too, we have a shortage of ministers, and that's exactly what we've begun to find out, is that we need to do the training necessary to get those men ready to replace those who are leaving the ministry for one reason or another, health, illness, age, whatever it might be. And so we need to be prepared to do the same thing. So the work today needs your prayers for those younger men and for those replacements that are needed to continue to carry on in the role of pastors and elders. And this is a big part of the growth and the expansion of the church today, too. So, it's a big part of what we're doing. And the apostles here in Acts were learning that they needed to lead and train and prepare more men for these kinds of positions, too. But they're learning it for the first time, kind of like, you know, we haven't experienced this before. In the Old Testament, we had a Levitical priesthood that was kind of automatic. If you were part of a priesthood family and you were a young person and you were growing up and your dad was a priest in the Old Testament, eventually you would probably end up being a priest too. And you knew it, and it was part of your training. And you worked physically maybe in the tabernacle for a while, and you learned all the principles of what priests do. And then when you came of age and you became 30 years of age, you also joined others who became priests in the tabernacle. But it was an automatic system set up so that these young men would eventually replace their parents and their peers. But in the New Testament, we didn't have a system in existence ready to go when the apostles were doing this. So it took them a little bit by surprise. And God began to use these men that were supposed to be doing physical duties in spiritual context as well. So I say, I have to give Mr. Kubik credit, because I think he's done more toward preparing young men to serve in the ministry than some of our previous presidents have been able to do. Not necessarily that they were negligent, but they had to convince the council of elders that now was the time to really begin preparing these young men. And sometimes the council was concerned, well, that's going to cost us more money than we've got in the budget to hire and train, and so there was a little bit of resistance. And I think finally they've realized how badly we need to begin replacing and training. And under Mr. Kubik, I think he was able to sway the council to realize that you've got to kick money into this process, or we aren't going to have the men that we need. And so that's been a good thing under Mr. Kubik. I have to give him all the credit, for that. We're told specifically what these wonders and signs were that Stephen was used to perform. I'm sorry, we're not told. Did I say we were told? We're not told exactly what these wonders and signs were that he did. But we have to assume that they're similar to the kinds of things that the apostles were doing too. Some commentaries believe these wonders and signs began before Stephen was ordained. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. I believe they were probably more as a result and because of the ordination personally, but the scriptures don't actually tell us for certain. But that's just my opinion. However, some commentaries do express that feeling, and they think it's because they were doing it before they were ordained. I tend to think it's probably after they were ordained. In verse 9, we clearly see Stephen is beginning to preach and teach some of his Hellenistic Jewish faith associates in the synagogue of the freedmen. It's interesting, the word freedman in Greek is actually libertion. I think you can see probably where we get our word liberty from, too, as well, from it. The Hellenist is actually Hellenistes, and it almost sounds like Hellenist as well in Greek. But the masculine gender of the Greek word here Hellenistes in verse 6:1 is the masculine gender, not the feminine gender that some of the commentaries may refer to. Not all commentaries are written by men who are Greek speakers. Sometimes they know a little bit of the language, but they don't always know some of the little details that they miss. And some commentaries seem to refer to this word Hellenistes as the feminine gender. The masculine gender of the word is what's here, and it literally means to imitate the Greeks. That's what Hellenist means. Or one who uses the language and follows the customs of the Greeks is another way to define it. In the New Testament, it refers to a Jew by blood, but a native of a Greek-speaking country. So you can have Jews in other countries. They may speak other languages, but typically the language of the empire, the lingua franca of the empire, was Greek. So typically they would speak Greek no matter what country they lived in, and then they would have had some other local languages, maybe whatever their native language might be as well. So some commentaries, of course, have postulated that because some conflict in the early church existed between the Israelites and the Hellenists, that the seven deacons ordained were and became to the Hellenists very much like the apostles were to the Israelites. I don't think that's probably true either, but you'll sometimes read that in commentaries. I think it's a misinterpretation. The Hellenists were actually of Israel. That's something that sometimes I don't think the commentaries seem to pick up on. They just spoke Greek at this point. It doesn't necessarily make them a Gentile because they speak Greek. Almost everybody in the empire spoke Greek. That doesn't make them all Gentiles. So there's, you know, I look at commentaries sometimes and I think, I wish they knew a little bit more about what they were talking about sometimes, but they don't always seem to do that. I believe the apostles were actually doing their best for the church as a whole here, but were pretty thinly spread. There were too few of them to do all of the things that needed to be done. I don't think it was necessarily because they were doing things for the Israelites and not doing things for the Hellenists. I think that's a misinterpretation of the commentaries. But later, after Paul comes on the scene in Acts 15, and we have the Acts 15 conference, that conference had to be held because the Jews were not agreeing with the Gentiles and coming into the church. There was no agreement on how Gentiles were to be treated. The Jews felt that all of the Gentiles had to be circumcised. They had to follow all the traditional Jewish laws. And the Apostle Paul clearly said, that's not necessary. That's overboard. And, of course, the conference had to be called because this was now a change between what some of the other apostles had been teaching. And Paul is now calling, not necessarily calling the conference himself, but the conference is being called because there was a controversy involved in it. And we know how it settled. But it's not certain how many synagogues Stephen was in contact with here in verse 9. Some say 5, some say 2, some say as few as 1. We aren't told in the scripture specifically, but we have no information about what Stephen may have been preaching to them. We don't know what he said or what he was teaching that made them dispute what Stephen was saying. But Luke labels their accusations against Stephen as false by his wording in chapter 7, and we'll see that in a few minutes. But in verse 10, there is a progression that occurs when the gospel is preached to those who do not believe or refuse to accept it at this time. And the synagogues were open to discussion. Oftentimes after a particular service and the scriptures were read, they would call on individuals to stand up and have something to say. And sometimes the something to say would lead to questions and controversy later in discussion in the synagogue. But resistance to the gospel, you know, goes from basically discussion to debate, and then from debate to slander, and then from slander to violence. And that's what frequently happens when you're dealing with the gospel being preached to people who are not being called. Sometimes they get very angry about it. And there's no love for the truth among those who are not being called by God, at least some of them. Some just simply blow it off and go their own way and ignore it. Others get angry about what's being said. In verse 11, we can see that progression moving to slander here in verse 11. And then in verse 12, the final step is being taken between slander and violence, and is now very close as Stephen is brought before the council, or the Sanhedrin, as it was called at the time. In verse 13, the testimony of witnesses of what someone said was standard procedure for a Jewish court. And that's why the, I should move forward here and say at the beginning of chapter 7, if I recall correct, it says something about the high priest. Yeah, then the high priest said, "Are these things so?" in chapter 7, verse 1. This is standard procedure. All of these witnesses have made their statements. The high priest then says to the the person being convicted, the defendant, yeah. He says to the defendant, "Are these things so?" You know, and they've had all these false witnesses who have made all these statements about Stephen. And so standard procedure, he's following standard procedure for a court trial in terms of what they did. You have all the witnesses make all their statements. Then you go to this person and say, "What's your defense? Do you have a defense for this? Or, you know, are these things so?" And then that person is expected to defend themselves. And so that's what we're seeing in verse 1. But we're not quite there yet. I'm still talking in here in the previous verses of the previous chapter. These testimony of the witnesses, someone has said standard procedure for a courtroom. Slander and false witnesses were often used to incriminate someone just before the violence begins, because that's the progression that we're seeing of unbelievers who are hearing the gospel, seeing what Stephen has been preaching and teaching. The issue here is no longer the gospel of Christ's work on this earth. They're now beginning to deal with other things, and false claims, other things are happening as well. Verse 14. Where am I at here? Okay. Verse 14 actually illustrates this clever deception as well. People of faith don't like to hear that their faith is under attack, or that it's being criticized or condemned or changed by those outside of the faith. And this was used to kind of capture the ire of those at the time, those of the Jewish faith. And these men from the Freedmen's Synagogue did four things in order to pursue Stephen. The first thing they did was they secretly persuaded some individuals to say that Stephen had spoken blasphemy. So they needed some false witnesses to testify that that's what he had done. The second thing they did was they stirred up the people, teachers of the law, elders, you know, others, concerning these trumped-up charges that they had made against him. And number three, they seized Stephen and took him before the Sanhedrin. And fourthly, they then brought forth more false witnesses at his trial. So it's interesting to see how this all progresses in the verses here. In verse 15, I'm not necessarily sure that Stephen's face actually shone as did Moses literally, or that it's shown figuratively, or both. I'm not really sure what is meant by Luke here. I don't know who the witness was, but there were probably at least two or three people in this, or on the Sanhedrin, that may have been church members, may have been even elders, maybe apostles, I don't know, that were actually part of the church. So they would have been in this procedure to hear what was going on. And I'm not sure whether this is a figurative statement or a literal statement or both. I don't know what we're actually seeing here in terms of his face shining. But he was preaching the gospel, and it shone in their minds as the truth. And so I think many of the people in the Sanhedrin saw it as a case of the truth, but they couldn't get past the fact that their religion was being attacked or being undermined by this Christian gospel, if you will. And so they couldn't get past, I mean, they got past the truth by denying it, I guess is maybe the way to say it. And so they're actually knowing that it's the truth, but they're ignoring the fact that it's the truth. Which or both it was here, whether it was figurative or literal or both, I don't know. God maybe can play us a video someday of exactly what happened, and we'll actually get to actually see it and understand what really did happen. That's kind of the end of chapter 6 here at verse 15, so I will stop and ask a question. Anybody have any questions about chapter 6 or thoughts on it? We're seeing the build up to his trial take place basically in this chapter. So, all right, doesn't look like any questions. Let's go to chapter 7, do a quick summary here of chapter 7. The primary message is that Stephen is seeking to present that Israel has always rejected all the prophets and the priests that God has sent to them. And we're going to see that by the end of chapter 7. The parable of the vineyard owner who lent his vineyard out to husbandmen while he went away in Luke chapter 20. He sent messengers to the wicked men who ran his vineyard in his absence and finally sent his son, the heir, to them, and they killed him. So we're seeing almost this same story taking place with Israel, and with God dealing with Israel and with the Jews in particular, just as the Jews had recently done to Jesus Christ. They killed the Son, and they had rejected all the prophets and priests and others that were sent to them. History reveals the patience of God and the hardness of men's hearts, as well as the Jews knew about their own history. They knew this, and when Stephen begins to talk about that, they're going to get really angry eventually. But he waits to challenge them on that until almost the end of his presentation. And Stephen's about to equate Jesus Christ with their Messiah, but he's going to do that very gradually, because if he does it right up front, they're going to take him right out and put an end to him right on the spot. And he knows he needs to be able to present some material for a while before they really get angry. And God has inspired him to kind of lead up to that moment rather than doing it too quickly. And when they see what he ultimately does, in this similar history that he's going to relate, will continue until Jesus Christ returns, until Israel sees that it is indeed Jesus Christ who was the Messiah that they missed, Zechariah 12:10. Then Israel and Judah will have the Spirit poured out on them in the millennium, and they will understand, and they'll realize how foolish they have been and what they have done to the Prince of Peace. But that's future. Unfortunately, they didn't see that at this moment. Okay, verse 1. After all of these false witnesses, the high priest begins the hearing with the obvious question, are these things so? Because now this is the next step in the judicial process. A cue for the defendant, basically Stephen, to begin to defend himself and to begin his statement of defense. So the primary charge against him seems to be blasphemy, at least at the opening. Up until this time, blasphemy was considered more from a viewpoint based on the law of Moses. Within a few years, the whole idea of blasphemy in the Jewish mind changes. Later, Jewish law only allowed the death penalty for someone who pronounced the sacred name of God. Basically, that was their whole view of blasphemy later. But at this point in time, they still stuck pretty close to what Moses said blasphemy was. But later, it just became, you know, if you use the name of God, you know, that was it. You know, they take you out and stone you. That was a death penalty. But this time, there were three great pillars of Jewish piety, I guess you could say, that were considered sacred. Number one, the land was considered a sacred thing in their concept. Number two was the law. The law was considered to be very sacred. That, of course, is the law of Moses that they're referring to. And number three was the temple. So there were three things that were considered extremely important and extremely sacred, or they were the laws of piety, so to speak, for the Jew. And blasphemy, of course, was considered anything that went against any of these three items. And so the witnesses claimed that Stephen was preaching against Moses and against God. And Moses brought them in the land, so it was blasphemy against the land, I guess is the way you could interpret it. And it was blasphemy against the temple, because the temple was God's temple. And we would consider this reasoning a little convoluted, but it was the way the Jewish reasoning went at the time. But instead of accusing the false witnesses of being such, Stephen doesn't attempt to discredit the witnesses. As the carnal mind, typically we would seek to discredit whoever was witnessing against us, but he doesn't approach it that way. He begins differently in verse 2, and his approach is to explain the gospel rather than defend himself. And his approach is not one seeking acquittal for himself. And it's obvious that God is speaking through Stephen here. And it's not just Stephen coming up with whatever he felt was good. Verse 2 begins almost with everyone being presented as a, everyone's forefather being presented as Abraham. And the Jews were very interested in people's ancestry. So he now has their attention. He's telling a story that they know. And as long as he's following the story the way it's told in the Old Testament, they'll hear him out, because that's part of this judicial procedure. And that ancestry often determined whether or not they would listen to you seriously and what you have to say. Unless, you know, if your ancestry was important enough, then they'd hear you out. And that's just kind of the way the Jewish mind worked. He then recites from memory the story of Abraham. Ask yourself, could you do that yourself under pressure? It's an interesting question to think about. Could I do that if I needed to? Verse 3, Abraham was told to get out of his country and from his relatives and come to a land I, God, will show you. How would you or I react to having God appear in a dream or through an angel and him telling you something like that? I want you to get out of your house, get out of your neighborhood. I want you to go to a land I want you to go to. How many of us could just drop everything and do that? Abraham was willing to do so. I think it came as somewhat of a shock to Abraham, but it was something he knew. If this is what God is asking me to do, I just better well do it. And so he did. And when you think about it, you know, isn't that happening when God called you? You're being called out of a land, of a different place, of a different way of life, into a wholly new way of life. That's exactly what God does when he calls us. He's calling us in the same way. Did your relatives take this major change in you lightly when God called you? What did your relatives think of you? Now, you know, it's great if your relatives are all in the church, but if they weren't in the church, you know, you probably received some interesting reactions from relatives. I know when I was a kid, my parents, I could tell people, you know, our relatives thought my parents were nuts. I mean, it was obvious to me as a kid, but I said, man, you know, that's great. We go to parties with relatives and things, and we'd go over to their house on Thanksgiving or something, and they had great food, so didn't bother me. I was 9 years old, you know, as long as there was plenty of pie, you know, with Thanksgiving, I was okay. But I'm sure my parents kind of went through a rough time with that, and I'm sure most of us who were called, you know, went through somewhat of a rough time with our relatives when they were not in the church. And the same thing's true here. In a way, Stephen is losing his connection with his Jewish family, with his people. At this point, only their hostilities are going to be more violent than Abraham's case when he left his relatives and came out of where he was living and moved to Haran. I can't remember whichever it was. He moved to another area. And when his father died, then he moved again, even further. So in Abraham's case, you know, he had to come out and he probably got some flack from some of his relatives too, when God asked him to move. In verse 4, here we see the transition from Chaldea to Haran, and Haran to Palestine. So there's this transition that's occurring that he goes through. And then in verse 5, then he makes a key point that Abraham received no specific land as his own in the promised land. He owned none of it. And while Abraham had no child to inherit his land and his wealth, God promised the land to him. How could Abraham possibly own it in the future when he didn't own it during his physical life and he had no children to pass it on to? So Abraham had to be a man of faith that if God said he was going to do this, he must be going to do it. You know, but I don't have any kids. I don't own any land there. How's he going to pass this on to me? Well, I think he eventually, it was a conundrum, but he finally realized that God can do that even after his death. And that's exactly what God's going to do. How could Abraham possibly own it in the future when those things weren't true? Well, I feel for Abraham and his predicament at this point in life. I would like to own some land and pass it on to my family, to my children too, when I'm gone, but we've not been successful in finding so far, but I'm hoping to eventually here. Yet just as God promised to Abraham when he couldn't possibly have it, it will all belong to Abraham and his seed one day, which is miraculous, but that's exactly what God does, miraculous things. So that's when it's going to happen. And when Christ returns, Abraham and his children will own that physical land. We know that to be the case today. Even though Abraham's dead, he believed God would do it, and he's going to. Abraham will own a piece of far greater real estate beyond his wildest dreams, I'm sure. He'll own a piece of New Jerusalem, and that's the piece of real estate that you and I want to own, too. Anyway, verse 6, Stephen records again the Egyptian captivity of Israel in verse 6. We begin to see all of this story of Abraham progressing. Stephen says that God will judge the nation that holds Abraham's descendants captive in verse 7. And wow, did he ever. All the miracles, all the suffering in Egypt that went, you know, that Israel went through and that God put Israel through and their travels in the desert and ultimately to the promised land, where they would serve God. Then in verse 8, Stephen relates the covenant of circumcision given to Moses as the sign of the old covenant between Israel and their God. Does anyone know what the sign of the new covenant is today? Old covenant was circumcision. What's the sign of the new covenant? No volunteers? Baptism. That's the sign of the new covenant. Then God gave Abraham a son, Isaac, who began, begat Jacob, and his 12 sons. So what's the lesson in all of this that Stephen is relating to the Sanhedrin? Why is he tackling this story? He hasn't come to it yet, but he is allowing their anger to cool. He's giving himself some time, telling them a story that they already know, that they're familiar with, that's good PR, so to speak. They can calm down from their immediate anger. And he relates something that they're all familiar with, and it's a very closely held belief by them. But at the same time, he's leading up to the coming of the Messiah, or who they thought was the Messiah, but they weren't sure who the Messiah was. But he is going to convince them that the Messiah was Jesus Christ, or he's going to try anyway. And they aren't going to want to hear it, of course, when he gets to that part. But the lesson for us in all of this is that God is faithful. He takes care of his people. He's working with them, and he will ultimately bring them, you and me, to the promised land one day, too. And, you know, that's part of the lesson he's conveying to them and to us today. In verse 9, Stephen shows how these 11 patriarchs became jealous of Joseph and sold him into Egypt. And we see the story of Joseph here, basically, and remember that Joseph was specifically the favored son, and was a type of Jesus Christ, the favored son of God the Father. And notice he was sold into Egypt, but God was with him. And again, as is God faithful to those people he's working with? Yes, indeed. They know the story, and they see that God's faithful in all of this. Then in verse 10, Joseph was delivered out of all of his troubles, and Joseph became favored in Pharaoh's house, and the second in command, of course, of the largest empire on the face of the globe at the time. And I say Joseph was well taken care of by God. Absolutely. Was God faithful to someone who followed him? Sure. Exactly. And that's what he's conveying to them. And he's going to talk about the faithfulness of the Messiah here in a minute too. Verses 11 and 12. Now the famine comes on Egypt and the whole world at this particular time. So Joseph's father, Jacob, begins, he hears that the only food basically is available in Egypt to buy. So he sends his 12 sons to Egypt to buy grain, or he sends some of his sons. I don't think he sent all 12 of them initially. Then in verse 13, then we see Joseph is made known to his brothers. They didn't know who he was, and so today Joseph is known to his brothers. Is he? Do people know who Joseph is today? No. Most of the world doesn't know who Joseph is today, nor vice versa. Do they know that they're maybe of Israelite stock? Most people don't know. Joseph's two children aren't even known to each other today, really. We have a close affinity with Great Britain and the British Empire, but I don't think anybody, or very few people, know anything about the real relationship between us. Yet they will know each other under Christ's millennial rule. They will come to know each other. They will know who they are, too. Verses 14 and 15. Then we see that Jacob and 75 of Joseph's relatives all come down to Egypt to dwell with him during the famine, and they all lived there until they died. And in verse 16, later when the children of Israel come out of Egypt, and their bones were brought up to Shechem, where Abraham had bought a tomb, and they were buried there in the land, so to speak, or in the promised land. Let's see, in verse 17, and as the end of the 400 years of Israel in captivity in Egypt, drew near. Israel had grown, and we probably are looking roughly at around 1 million people that come out of Egypt under Moses' leadership. And then in verse 17, at the end of, verse 17, the end of that, about 1 million are coming out. And then verses 18 and 19, and Pharaoh's that came to power thereafter did not know Joseph and did not know what Joseph had done in Egypt nor his seed, and they were all thrown into slavery to the Egyptians at some point. And the Egyptians were killing their babies, and much like in America today we do, it's sad, but that's what the Egyptians were doing at the time. We consider it a terrible crime what they were doing to Israel then. And yet in Israel today, with abortion, we're killing our children at probably an even greater rate than the Egyptians were. Tragic. Verse 20. And at this point, Stephen begins relating the story of Moses, another familiar, greatly honored figure to the Jews of the day. Now, by introducing Abraham and Moses, who were types of God the Father and Jesus Christ, Stephen is subtly preparing the Sanhedrin, to see Jesus Christ as the Messiah or the Son of God, but he's doing it very skillfully here. He hasn't come right out and said that yet. Then in verse 21, Moses was set out or placed in an ark of bulrushes and set out in the waters of the Nile, where Pharaoh's sister or royal family members might find him. And God took care of that too. Queen Hatshepsut probably ruled between 1501 and 1482, is likely the woman who adopted Moses. She is about 26, maybe 27 years old, and she's without child at this point. And so she's just past what would have been the peak child-rearing age of the day. And back in that day, if a woman hadn't had children by that age, it was kind of like, this is a really sad story. If you didn't have children as a woman, you weren't fulfilled, you weren't successful. And so she was probably viewed in that way by Egyptian people, and maybe the hierarchy as well, I don't know. But she needed a child. And so she adopts this small child that's in the Ark of Bulrushes. And in verse 22, meanwhile, Moses grows up in her household as her son and as a royal. And he's learning all of the wisdom of the Egyptians. As he grew, he becomes mighty in words and deeds. Then in verse 23, when he turned 40 years old, he somehow discovered his roots, that he was of Israelite background, not Egyptian. And he went to visit his brethren who were serving in slavery. And in verse 24, because of his family and roots, Moses becomes sympathetic to the Israelites' predicament and their situation, and being driven into slavery by the Egyptians. And so seeing one of them suffer, he defended that individual and struck down an Egyptian who was abusing him. Verse 25. And this verse can be a little controversial because Stephen, I think, is saying, isn't revealed in Exodus specifically. Stephen seems to be saying here that Moses already knew that God would deliver the Israelites from the Egyptians at this point. I don't know if that's the case. But Stephen, I think, is speaking under inspiration here. So, maybe he does know. Maybe there was a tradition that said that this was the case. And so he's reciting a tradition that they had. And maybe he's absolutely right. I don't know. The Exodus story doesn't give us those specific details, but the Israelites didn't realize he would be the deliverer, but yet we get the impression that maybe some of them knew this, or that rumor was going around at this point in time. The story in Exodus makes it appear that God doesn't reveal his plans to Moses until much later at the burning bush. after Moses had left Egypt, was married and living with his father-in-law in Midian. But Stephen's story is also biblical, also inspired, so perhaps it is and was a known fact that this was the case in the Exodus story. The Jews don't make any big deal out of it, so apparently they knew this part of the story as well. In verse 26, the next day Moses appears before the two Israelites fighting, and he criticizes their violence to one another and trying to reconcile their dispute with one another. And then in verses 27 and 28, and the one Israelite who was the aggressor in the fight asked Moses, "Who made you a judge and prince over us? And do you want to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" That was undoubtedly a shock to Moses. You know, what I did yesterday that I thought was in secret is well known suddenly. Verse 29, Moses realizes that he's killed an Egyptian. It was known, so he decided, "I better flee before Pharaoh comes to pick me up," or the Pharaoh's police or whoever it was that came out to do that. And so he flees from Egypt to Midian, and he stays there. He eventually marries and has two sons there in Midian. Sorry, it's kind of a secondhand story at this point, but Stephen is coming to a point. And in verse 30, Stephen jumps ahead to 40 more years in Moses' life when he comes to the burning bush. He's now 80 years old. Now, if Moses did know that God was going to have him lead the Israelites out of Egypt at the age of 80, he's either forgotten it or he's assumed God really wasn't serious if he knew it 40 years ago. God must have forgotten or something, you know, that he's not really serious. But God's time frame's a little different than Moses probably realized too. And God tells him and confirms it to him, "I can't imagine what he must be thinking now. I'm 80 years old and you want me to do this?" Surely God could find somebody younger to do this work than me. I can't imagine what was all going through Moses' mind at the burning bush when God said, "Yeah, I'm gonna send you to Egypt." Can you imagine being told at the age of 80 you're going to Egypt to lead Israel out from under the Pharaoh? I get tired. I lack the energy I once had. I can imagine being 80 and being told that now it's time for you to do what I told you were going to do a long time ago. Of course, God gave him all the health, the leadership, the strength, the glibness of tongue that he needed to do the job, even though he probably didn't think he had any of those things. And maybe he didn't have them at this point, but God was going to give them to him. But you can see why Moses was a little hesitant to accept the assignment, and he tried to talk God out of it. And in verse 31, now Moses sees the burning bush, that it is not consumed. He decides, "I better go over there and see what this is all about." And verse 32, saying, "I, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob," rather than saying, "I am the God of your fathers," Stephen is careful not to use the name of God, "I am." He doesn't use that phrase here before the Sanhedrin. That would have gotten him into even deeper yogurt than he was already in, in front of the Sanhedrin. So he says, "I, the God," or basically theos in Greek here, if he was speaking Greek. If he was speaking Aramaic, it may have been Allah. I'm not sure exactly what term he used. But it's recorded in Greek for us, so I assume he says I rather than I am. He says ego in Greek instead of ego emi, which is I am. It's actually I am when it's said that way, and that is technically in Greek the name of God, and the Sanhedrin would not have taken that very well. They might have stoned him immediately if he had used ego emi. Or I am phrase to them right there. But he just simply says I rather than I am. In verse 33, God tells Moses to take off his sandals because he's standing on holy ground. Now, what makes it holy? What makes something holy? It's coming into contact with God, right? Coming into contact with God. And that makes something sacred or holy. And because the Spirit of God is and continues to be in contact with God, it is also holy. It's not a person, but it is an it, and it's divine because it's in connection or connected to God. Meaning if you have God's Holy Spirit in you, what do you become? Holy. We are a holy people because we have God's Spirit. Verse 34, God says, He has seen the suffering of His people in Egypt, and He has come down to deliver them and tells Moses He is sending him to Egypt. Now, in this whole story, I suspect there's someone in the Sanhedrin who is a Christian who is hearing this testimony. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have as much written about what happens during this judicial procedure as we do. Certain individuals I know were undoubtedly on or eligible to be in the Sanhedrin meeting, even if they were not members of the Sanhedrin themselves. The Sanhedrin met within the area that was restricted to the priests in the temple, which means if you're a priest, you could be in there. If you weren't a priest and you weren't a member of the Sanhedrin, then you couldn't get in there. So basically, I think that's part of the requirement here. And who's there that would have met those requirements? Two of the apostles, and probably others too, James and John, sons of Zebedee, they were priests. Their father was Eli, of the tribe of Levi. Their mother was Jewish, the sister of Mary. So their father's line was a priesthood line, and they were both priests. So James and John could easily have been in there during hearing what was going on. They may not have been members of the Sanhedrin, we don't know. But it's possible that James may have been. He was well respected among the priests. And I'm running out of time. But they could have been in the area listening in. Remember, Saul, who became Paul, is also here. Why? Well, because he's of the tribe of Benjamin. He's not a priest himself, but he is a member of the Sanhedrin or was in training under one of the members of the Sanhedrin. I'm not sure which it was at this particular point in time. So Moses now knows that he's going to Egypt, and probably verse 35 is a good place for me to close off here. I wish I could go on, but because it's a very interesting story to hear it all. I was hoping to cover a little more ground, but you know, you do your best. Anyway, any questions about chapter 7 so far? We'll pick up with verse 35 next time. Right. I don't see any hands. Yes.
I was thinking, isn't this kind of also kind of a subtle way, maybe it's like a B or C, kind of a subtle way of disarming the false witnesses, because he's going through all this real testimony that, hey, this is what I believe.
Yeah.
But he hasn't quite come to the point yet where he's going to, you know, bring Christ into the picture, you know.
Yeah.
And that it seemed like there's several things. Maybe another one, it was kind of like common ground, like you were saying, kind of disarming them as well, preparing them. And
giving them time to cool off. Yeah, all of that. Now, it was a disarming way to present himself without actually having to attack directly those who were criticizing him. So, yeah, the false witnesses.
It's probably a little different subject, but when you bring up Moses, how did the queen... I mean, how was he wrapped in that manger, or when he's floating down? Wasn't it in an Israeli-type cloth? I wonder if she knew about it, whether he knew he was Jewish growing up.
I don't know his, you know, if you watch the movie The Ten Commandments, you probably have all this figured out in your head and you already know what's going on. But I don't know how accurate the movie is in terms of exactly what happened either. But
and he kind of wondered, why was he just that much of a just individual? He saw something occurring and he told what it was because he knew he's kind of Jewish and, you know, that, hey,
I think we all have a certain sympathy for, or maybe not a sympathy, but a leaning toward our ancestry in one way or another. And he finds out as he's older that he's not maybe who he thought he was. And I suspect maybe his mom tended to make that Jewishness disappear as quickly as she could because she wanted him to be Egyptian and to, you know, be one of the potential individuals who could become Pharaoh one day, and also to bury that side of it so that he was legitimately a leader among the Egyptians. But I don't know. I think the movie kind of presents it that way, but I don't know if that's the case. You know, hard to say whether, you know, how much does Hollywood really get right, you know. pretty questionable sometimes, so I don't know. Anyway, thank you and for coming, and we'll pick it up next time.